The Great Recession has a big birthday coming up on Saturday. It should be the least joyous fifth birthday ever recorded. It was 5 years ago in December that the recession began, according to the arbiters of these things. Yet here we are. All these years later, the United States can't manage to get any sustained growth much above 2%. Unemployment is 7.9%. And at the rate of growth we're managing, there's little reason to expect it to come down much anytime soon. So happy birthday, Great Recession. May your birthday cake be poisoned, its candles exploding, and after the party, may you get hit by a truck. That's from a sarcastic column by Neil Irwin in late November 2012 in the Washington Post, suggesting we are still suffering the effects of the Great Recession. I'm Emily Auerbach.
I'm Norman Gilliland. This is University of the Air.
Economists claim that America went through a Great Recession from December 2007 to June 2009. A little over 5 years after it began, what is the state of our economy today? How do we know when we're in a recession, a depression, or a recovery? Over 5 years after the Great Recession began, what is the state today of poverty, of the distribution of wealth, the housing market, and unemployment? Joining us to explore the enduring impact of the Great Recession is Timothy Smeeting, Arts and Sciences Distinguished Professor of Public Affairs at the La Follette School of Public Affairs and Director of the UW's Institute for Research on Poverty.
Welcome to University of the Air.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
My first question I'm tempted to ask, does anybody really know anything about economics?
I think we know something about economics, but how to do the right thing is really difficult. We haven't been in a time like this literally since the Great Depression. And there is a confluence of a financial recession, an employment recession, and a housing collapse or a housing bubble that's collapsed. And they interact in pernicious ways and make recovery for the normal individual, your middle-class family, much more difficult than in previous times.
Is there a difference between a cycle, which we're all familiar with, up cycles, down cycles, and various kind of business, manufacturing, the stock market and all that? Is there a difference between that and something that's actually broken here?
Yes. The financial cycles, when you have a financial crisis, it generally takes a very long time, 7, 8, 10 years to recover. But you put the employment crisis on top of it and the housing crisis, and it just interacts in a way that's very difficult. And at some point, people might say, well, this is all cyclical. But how long does the cycle have to last before it has permanent effects on people? There are economists out there who say this is all about a cycle. You know, in 5 years, jobs will come back. And what happens to the people who couldn't find jobs in the 3.5 years so far since the bottom of the recession, not to mention the 5.5 years since it began, and then 5 more years? That's a decade. That's a lost generation.
Let's get some terms down, starting with that term recession and this use of the phrase Great Recession to describe this 2007 to 2009 period. How do you know you're in a recession? You know, what do you have to have in order to make it?
Well, the National Bureau of Economic Research tells you when you're in a recession, and it's when output declines significantly for 2 quarters in a row. And it did. And the curious thing about this recession is we're producing more now. Our total output in the country is above where it was when the recession began. So it's above the previous peak. But in terms of employment, we're way, 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 way behind. We've lost 3.5 or 4% of jobs. And that was for the population we had at the beginning of the recession. There's been some population growth since, and we haven't expanded to meet their needs either. So there's this big yawning job shortage. And for many people, there's a lot of concern that jobs won't come back. Certain types of work almost certainly won't come back. And that the jobs that do come back are going to be quite polarizing. There's either going to be the haves, the highly educated, the professional classes, the well-educated, the postgraduate degrees, people who are paid really well, and then the people at the very bottom who essentially work for them.
So we're producing more but with fewer people?
Yeah. So there's good news and bad. There's a term called productivity. And if I told you productivity increased, you'd think, oh, that's great.
Right.
We're producing more output with less input. That's good. I mean, prices should fall. We can be more competitive. And all that's true. But the trouble is we aren't creating enough jobs for the people who are displaced. And Wisconsin's in a particularly bad spot because our economy relied very heavily on manufacturing and on construction, which used to be the roads to the middle class. You didn't need a college degree. Your dad, you go be an apprentice where dad worked and or mom worked, and that would be it. But dad and mom don't have their jobs anymore or have lost their jobs and might have been, you know, retired early. And the jobs just aren't there for high school graduates. So if by age 30 all you've got is a high school education and no skills beyond that, you're in very deep trouble. You're the sorts of jobs that are being churned out very rapidly in this economy pay $9, $10, $11 an hour, and that really isn't enough to support a family on.
So would there be a demand for those people if magically they had a college degree?
We hope so. And I think there would be. There is a problem. We are in a cycle. Demand is down. There's no doubt about it. And right now, firms can hire by – if you have 100 jobs and 1,000 people apply, you need to sort on something. For the first thing you do is you say, we'll only take people – and this happens quite often – who are currently working. And it's – we won't even consider if you're unemployed. We want somebody who's already got work history and is working. And the next thing they'll say is, we've got 300 people here in the pool with bachelor's degrees. So forget the other 700 people. Just let them go. And among this 300, you get people who will work for things that they're overtrained for in this job shortage period. But they'll have a job, and they'll invest, and they'll work, and they'll use their heads. And when the economy comes back, those people will move up the job chain. Okay? The big problem is the long-term unemployed. And if employers say only the employed need apply.
Right. It's hard to break into that.
Yeah, and the longer you're unemployed, right, the harder it gets to break into
it.
And if you happen to have been in prison before, or you're a high school dropout, or you're a minority male, it's all that harder. I mean, it's in 1999 in Wisconsin, if you could walk, talk, or chew bubble gum, you got a job. A store like Target, that's the French store Target, would advertise for, we need 100 people. 30 would show up. They'd raise the wage. They'd say, we'll offer more. Maybe they get 40 the next week, and some of the same people. And what are you going to do? Well, you're going to hire some. You're going to give somebody a chance who needs a chance, and they'll learn a new job and whatever. But in an economy where you're looking for 100 people and 1,000 or 1,500 show up, then you can pick and choose, and employers right now can pick and choose.
Well, if we try to back up to look at what caused the Great Recession, you know, to understand how that came about, you know, why we're still suffering its impacts today, it seemed as if it came about around the same time that you had all the banking crisis and the bank bailout. You know, Norman started by asking, does anybody know what to do about the economy? And it does seem as if for the average person who's not an economics Nobel laureate or anything, it is immensely confusing to try to sort through the news on the economy and to make sense of billion-dollar bailout here and, you know, various decisions. Mm-hmm. It's very confusing.
Well, the first thing I could say are the banks were too big to fail. Without a monetary system, the country's in trouble. And the problem was very loose regulation. So it started actually in the Clinton administration and then the Bush administration. They pushed people to buy homes. The thing to do is to buy a house, okay? The industry wanted to sell houses. The mortgage lenders wanted to lend money. These were bundled together as in real estate investments and sold to pension funds and others. The credit rating agency said these were good investments and gave them A's, and the ball just got way out of control. And all of a sudden it collapsed, and somebody was left holding the bag.
And why did it collapse when it did?
Things were just moving too fast. It was illogical that people could afford to keep into the homes that they were in. Banks were overextended. You know, you get a little bit of somebody's money and then you try and multiply it into other people's money. And we have bank, you know, the FDIC has tight requirements for most regular banks about that. But the equity traders and, you know, the hedge fund managers found ways to multiply, you know, place big risks and big investments. And all of a sudden, the investments didn't look that good. All of a sudden, things started to fall.
Let's say you're buying a house in Detroit in, what, 2000, six or something like
God
that.
God bless you.
What kind of terms could you get?
Well, what happened is it was that Detroit is one place. Detroit's been declining. That's pretty solid. But you could go some places in California or Nevada, and you could put 5% down, sometimes nothing down. You could buy a house with very little down that costs a very lot, and you found ways to give people mortgages that they would start out at a very low rate and then it would balloon later, assuming their incomes would rise and so forth. And the classic story is in some parts of California, you had janitors buying $500,000 homes and being approved without putting anything down.
Is that for real?
That happened, but that's an excess. Let me just – here's what really happened, okay? I mean, this is the more the average story, okay? We told the emerging black and Latino middle classes that they should buy homes, they should put down roots, they should find a neighborhood with good schools, and that was the right thing to do. So they did that. And they did that in 2005 and 2006. They bought at the top of the market. Then a real estate crash came through. Credit stopped. People didn't want to lend money. People couldn't buy homes. And then the home building industry was falling and manufacturing was falling and you don't need appliances anymore. So the home and the building industry, construction industry is a big engine. And it was going in – it's going in reverse, okay? People in financial services were being laid off and so forth. But suppose you bought a $100,000 house in 2005, and even suppose you did the right thing. You put 20% down. That's the FHA. Great. Now – that's 2005. Now it's 2009, and you've lost a job, and you're told that your house is worth $70,000, the average decline in the country up until the beginning of this year, which just started to turn around, is 30%. So you have an asset that's worth $70,000. You're on the hook for paying $80,000 for it, and you've lost your $20,000. You're what they call underwater. And then you've lost your job, and you're having real trouble paying your mortgage. And, of course, if you can't pay your mortgage, you're not going to pay your property taxes, okay? You can't do other things to keep the house up. And it's a pernicious circle, and more people lost their jobs. And the ball just kept rolling. The credit companies tightened everything up because they had made enough bad loans. They were bailed out. They were saved. And many of them did need saving. Without a financial system, it would have been total chaos. But, you know, this creates this very unfortunate too-big-to-fail situation that we were in. Well, there's the insurer of insurers, AIG. They actually insure banks, insure other big bets and whatever. They're going to go broke then. There's no insurance anywhere, and people, the money just stops moving and it collapses. And when you put that housing crisis in with the employment crisis and the banks being really tight on lending, you create a perfect recipe for disaster. So now here we sit with borrowing rates at all-time lows, but without people who can qualify for those loans and buy mortgages. So older people have homes to sell, but there isn't a young group to buy them. College graduates are living with their parents because they can't find a decent job. At some point, they will. Trust me, if you had a choice, are you going to send your kid to college or not? Your kid's going to have a much better future and much better choices as a college graduate. But it's hard to find a good job now as a college graduate. So we're in this situation, and if you thought that you were one of those people who were going to go into the construction industry or go into the manufacturing industry, those jobs closed.
What about the problem? There's just the concept of buying that we seem to be based on. In other words, this idea it's good for the economy to go out and, you know, go Christmas shopping or, you know, go and buy something or build another house or do another development. I mean, aren't we based on growth and material purchases at a sort of where you have to keep on adding? Is there a flaw in the system?
Well, you have to keep on adding in some ways, but in some ways, you know, we can sell our products. We can sell business services to China. Our tractors, for instance, John Deere and Caterpillar, they supply the whole world. So there are industries and places, but without the American consumer base, without people buying, there's not going to be much hiring. And the problem right now is corporations are sitting on tons of cash. They're just not using them to hire people because they're unsure about the recovery. I think, by the way, that the end of the week thing, the sequestration is just small. But if we don't solve some sort of budget problems and do something about long-term issues in Social Security and Medicare within the next year, then those employers are going to stay on the sideline or do what Apple did. Take their money to China. Build all those products that we all have from Apple, from iPhones to iPads in China.
Well, if we're talking about Social Security and Medicare, things get pretty complicated, don't they? Because, I mean, if you take, for example, if you're going to reduce these entitlements somehow, is that what you're saying?
There's a short-term problem and a long-term problem. The short-term problem is the Great Recession. It may seem long to you, but it's in terms of it's economic recovery. It's maybe infrastructure building if we'd have done the $800 million for the railroad. Or it's the Keystone Pipeline for the country if Obama were willing to let the Canadians run their oil down through here. Or it's bridges and dams and infrastructure. I mean, that sort of thing and stimulating the economy in the short term and starting to get people back into the habit of buying cars or buying homes and so forth, that's the cyclical problem. That's the short-term problem. The long-term problem is me, the baby boomer, me and a whole herd of my brothers and sisters. We're all going to retire. We're all going to collect Social Security. We're all going to use the Medicare program.
You're living too long. you were supposed to die at the age of 65 or something.
Exactly right. Well, there is something, and this is true. If you pass out free cigarettes in high school, if we did that, people paying, they get really sick and they die early on. And then
good for
no
the tobacco
survivors.
Industry.
Yeah, good for the tobacco industry. Good for Social Security. It actually, there are studies that show it is good for the Social Security system. But that's not the life, of course, we want.
No.
But the idea is we are going to live longer. Many of us started work later because we went to school. So the idea that we'd have to work a little bit longer or get a little less benefits makes some sense to me. You just can't do it tomorrow. You can't tell someone who's 64 or 65 that, hey, you're not going to retire at 67. You have to wait till you're 70. You can't do that. We need to do this further out. We need to tell the most well-to-do among the elderly that, you know, they need to pay more of their health care costs. We need to try and do all the things to restrain costs we can. And the long-term markets, the belief in the dollar as a lending currency and so forth, rests heavily on our ability to put a cap on our debt and to reduce our deficit. And we're not going to just grow our way out of this. If you asked me, would you rather take $100 billion from an elderly person who is well-to-do and give that to a kid who needs a scholarship to go to school or early childhood education or all of these other investments that we think we so desperately need in this country in the young generation, the answer is yes, of course, that makes sense. But it's the politics of doing it. It's telling that big block of voters that, don't get me wrong, recession hasn't been terribly good on older people. Now, an older person who bought a home for $100,000 and thought it was worth $500 and now it's only worth $350, I'm not worried about. But a lot of older people tried to live on interest rates, and the good news of low borrowing means low return. So they've had to eat a little bit into their capital. But many of them are able to work later, work longer in life, especially the most educated ones. Professors never die. We trundle off wherever, and we have a pension that we save for ourselves. But, you know, it's always fine to teach a class here and there or do a little consulting here and there. So those of us who are in that situation can afford to pay a little bit more and give up a little bit so that the next generation can be better prepared to compete in the 21st century.
You're the director of the Institute on Poverty. When we come back in a moment, I'm going to ask you about poverty in the aftermath of the Great Recession. More in a moment with University of the Year. I'm Emily Auerbach, back with Norman Gilliland. Our guest is Timothy Smeeting, and we are talking about the impact of the Great Recession. One of the things that seems to be a constant is poverty in this country. No matter what changes at the top level, we seem to have poverty, and it doesn't seem to be getting any better. Can you talk about that and why in a country like ours we have so many people who are poor?
Well, there's a lot of different reasons. The what's we know, there are a lot of poor people, and the whys are the more difficult thing. And some of the whys have to do with, first of all, economic change, that workers at the bottom of the economic ladder, especially after the Great Recession, have a hard time finding a job and keeping a job. And if they find it, it won't support their families by itself. Then we have demographic explanations. If I could change one thing about people's lives, it would be to stop young adults from having children at too early an age. The story I tell my students, and it makes perfect sense, is we all want our children to finish school, get a job, find a partner, make a plan, have a baby. Now take have a baby and put it back at the front of that. Before you finish school, before you've got a job or a career, before you found a partner and you never had any plan, and it turns out that if you've had one child early without finishing high school, that you're going to have two more kids. Most of the population growth, the large families, are at the lower level. At the other end, college graduates, your first kid is born at age 28. You have 1.5 kids per family, two parents who work. They've been saving to invest in this kid. The trouble is every parent wants to do everything they can for their children, but some are just much more able. So there's this situation, and it's pernicious. Kids who grow up with parents who are under a lot of stress, or who parents who have trouble keeping food on the table or keeping them in one spot and shifting homes and things from moving residences, or living in complex families, we call them, where someone will have a child with two different parents, both unmarried, and no one's supporting anybody. This creates a really terrible situation to get out of. Now, it's easier to get out of that situation, and we were getting out of it in the late 90s when the economy was really hot because you could go out and work. And we have these wonderful refundable tax credit programs, the children's tax credit and the earned income tax credit, that you only get if you work, and they help boost your incomes, help make ends meet. So that's been doing a great job. And the Obama administration and the state of Wisconsin did a great job in pushing our food share program, which says that a country as rich as ours, everyone should be able to eat. And the program isn't terribly generous, maybe $300 a month for a family of three, which isn't really enough to feed them. There are various journalists. I keep getting calls of journalists in this state, in New York, and in Washington, who are trying to live on $29 right. worth of food a week. And I say, don't use any of those fancy spices when you buy those beans. You can't drink anything. You know, you can't buy toilet paper with that. So make sure that you and it's difficult. But we in Wisconsin have done, in particular, have done a fantastic job in saying these are programs for which people are eligible, and let's make sure they get the benefits for which they're eligible. And the poor, believe it or not, have survived this recession pretty well because of that.
The poor nationwide or in Wisconsin?
In Wisconsin in particular, and more generally nationwide. I mean, these are income support programs. They're targeted. They're fairly easy to gain access to. We encourage enrollment. I mean, what's wrong with the food share? A, you can only spend it on food. You can't buy alcoholic beverages. You can't even buy vitamin pills with it. B, you're going to spend it locally. You're going to spend it in a local supermarket or on a local grocer or in a local farmer's market. And what's wrong with feeding families when we know that when kids are malnourished, they don't do well in school? And so what's wrong with this? And the problem is, well, it's too big. Well, it's too big because we're in a really bad problem. That's why we've got a lot of unemployed.
Residency requirement for Wisconsin or other states?
In Wisconsin, there's a residency requirement generally. What Wisconsin does is the following two things. And first of all, what happened in about 2001, they used to have a car test that said if you had a car that was worth more than $4,000, meaning something could get you to work or back, then you couldn't qualify. So they get rid of that. Then they had a liquid asset test that said if you had any money at all in the bank, $2,000, you were ineligible. They got rid of that. Then we went to debit cards. So you didn't have to go in and peel off stamps and be embarrassed. You just, if you go to Trader Joe's where I shop, you slash your card. You see debit, credit, employee, food share. And if you tick food share and you only buy food, you just walk out with your groceries like everybody else. And fraud can be limited by keeping this card. You can apply online for the card. Wisconsin has won awards for both helping the people who needed the program get it early and for reducing errors in the back end. In other words, people who, I forgot I got a job. My income's higher than it was. Recovering payments. We've won. This is the floor that's beneath the incomes of the poor. It makes ends meet. The other thing is refundable credits, child tax credit. You only get this if you work. And if you work, there's an earned income credit that says that if you have two children and you make $15,000 this year, the federal government gives you $5,000 tax refund, including the child credit, and the state adds on now 11% of that, another $550. And this comes once a year. It's not spread out, but it helps pay the bills. It helps meet back rent. It helps, you know, a popular thing to do is to not pay your utility bills because you know that they're not going to throw you out when it's freezing, but when the check comes and right. you pay your utility bill. So people, but this is how they make ends meet.
And it's a Band-Aid. But it's a Band-Aid.
It's a Band-Aid. It's a Band-Aid because you need a job that's steady, that pays more than $10 an hour. That's the solution to poverty. But if you don't have those jobs, and we build our system, you know, on jobs, and jobs are the most important thing and the highest value in America, and there aren't jobs, there's real trouble. What do you do? Mm-hmm. I mean, suppose you take a job at $8 or $9 or $10 an hour in a nursing home, and you have two kids, and it's part-time.
And you have child care.
You have child care, cost of going mm-hmm. to work. Yes, you do. You have health care expenses. The two good things about Wisconsin is we provided for families with children. We provide child care that's subsidized for low-income people, and we have Badger Care. And those programs have made it possible to take a job without health insurance or worse, with crappy health insurance, which costs you way more, or to have child care so that you can leave your kids safely and go to work. So those things are helpful, but you know, there's two sorts now in the country. They talk about, you know, flexible work. Flexible work for an employee of the state university or employee of this radio station is that my child is sick, I have to stay home today, or I have to go to the doctor's this afternoon. And as long as the work gets done, you come in early, stay a little late, that's fine. That's flexible work from the point of view of the employee. Today, in many big box and chain stores, there's flexible work from the point of view of the employer. You showed up at 8 a.m. and you thought you were going to work 8 hours. And they say, we don't need you till 10. So you don't punch in till 10. You work till 4 or to 3 or to 2. And then they say, oh, not enough people now, punch out. So you came in to work 8 hours and you ended up working and getting paid for only 4 or 5 hours. Now, that's flex time to the advantage of the employer.
Well,
it's great to say, just sit there or go home early. And I'm sorry. And in order to save costs and all the things we learn from barcoding and supply chain management and understanding how inventories move, employers can do this now. They can tell you very easily, somebody, an engineer or an economist, can sit down and tell you about how many hours you're wasting, quote unquote, here and there. And it turns out that, you know, so you don't even get 8 hours of work, even at a low wage.
What role do unions play in this whole phenomenon?
Unions used to play a big role. They play much less a role now. My dad was a union carpenter in Buffalo, New York, and we all know about General Motors. And the unions were built around manufacturers and trade unions. And then in many cases where there was a profitable employer who was making a lot of money, the employees thought that, well, there's no real competition in this industry, like the airline industry, so we should organize. And then the public sector unions came in and said, well, you know, this was true. Back in 20 years ago, a public sector job didn't pay as much as a private sector job. It didn't. But you knew that you were going to get good benefits, a pension, and after a certain period of time, you could retire. Then the whole world changed. The trades went downhill. Virtually every manufacturer in this country has a team A and a team, like the airline pilots do. Team A are the old style people who are these older workers who still get paid $30 and $40 an hour, and they work their hours. But then everything else is contracted out to somebody who hires people at $10 an hour. So if you go to a Caterpillar plant, from 9 to 5, they make the best tractors in the world, highly mechanized, people who learn to operate sophisticated machinery with some assembly still. And then at 5 o'clock, somebody comes in, they guard the building, they clean the floors, they fill the bins. One engineer or two tunes up the machines for the next day, and they cut the grass, they leave. And the A team comes in the next day. And so the B team is making $10 and $12 an hour, or, you know, some of those pilots who fly those small jets for the big airlines that we get in and out of here, and they make about $25,000 or $30,000, $35,000 a year.
For flying a jet.
Yeah, and an older A-line guy who's 55 or 60, takes the big planes across the sky to Europe or to South America or across the country, and then they make a couple hundred thousand. The trouble is, in America, labor doesn't have a voice. And you go to Germany or go to any other country, there's a labor party. Somebody looks out for labor. Wages are set more broadly. You're not able to take advantage of workers. We're the only country in the rich world that does not have a national family leave program, family and medical leave program. We just don't have it. And then what this means is that labor is going to lose. And if you need less labor now, I mean, there are many people who are working at X dollars an hour and are going back to work at the same job for $5 and $10 less because that's what the employer says and this is the only job.
Well, I mean, if you're an employer and you say, look, times are tough, I can only afford to give you 10 bucks an hour. Gosh, it's a good thing we don't have a union that's requiring me to pay 20.
Yeah.
Well, otherwise, you would have no job at 20 or you could have a job at 10.
But that's and part of it. It's like the minimum wage in some sense. The higher you push wages, the fewer people are going to be employed and the more skills that are going to be demanded. So in Europe, where minimum wages are very high, they spend a lot of money in training programs, training people. They know that if you're going to hire this guy for 12 euros an hour, which is 12 euros an hour is what?
$18
an hour, they better be productive or the business won't last. And so they spend a lot of their money in active labor market programs, they call them, training people to be good employees. We're just starting to get into that. We haven't really done that. And if you do raise the minimum wage or if you do force higher wages on employers, they're going to try and economize on labor. See, this is where the robots come in. Robotics is amazing. You might have seen 60 Minutes about 3 weeks ago. Scott Pelley opens up in a distribution center for Amazon. Okay. And what you do is you get online and you tell Amazon you want something and it'll be there in 2 days. And someone somewhere takes package 42, picks it up, moves it over, drops it in bin 18, and then does it again. Only that somebody is a robot. All robots. All robots. A couple of engineers from UW-Madison who make the robots run correctly and program the robots, but it's robotic. Manual tasks, simple, repeatable manual tasks are just on the way out.
Right.
And, I mean, you can think of training blacksmiths in the 18th century or bank tellers. It's the same thing. Machines don't require pension plans. Machines are much more reliable in general. Machines don't need health insurance policies, which cost employers $15,000 a year right now. And then you ask, well, who owns the robots, which I asked several times in my work, and it's the people who own the firm, own the businesses. So the recession forced a lot of firms who wanted to remain competitive to get lean and mean, to do more with fewer people, to use more new technology. And now they're finding that, hey, technology can do an awful lot of things.
Right, and that keeps a lot of people unemployed. Isn't the big question besides labor the unfair distribution of wealth?
Well, it's unfair in some sense. It's
compared to other countries, isn't it true that America has a pretty big split between, say, a CEO's salary and that other workers, that we have the biggest gap,
that the
wealth in this country is consolidated in the hands of a very few.
Productive wealth is owned by the stockholders of a company, which includes the University of Wisconsin Pension Plan, TIA CREF, which is the pension plan I was before I was here. People who have saved or own firms, some shares of firms, benefit. At the very top of the distribution, as we globalize markets, there's winner-take-all phenomenon. If you're really good and you're really entrepreneurial, you make a lot of money. And you reward yourself more than, let's say, your other employees. Your loyalty is to the bottom line and not so much to your workers. And at the end of the day, you make so much money in a year that it's got to accumulate over time. So that's where our wealth distribution comes from. Now, if you looked at your average family out there, most of their wealth is in their home. And we just said that in the last 7 or 8 years, the home value dropped by 30%. So the wealth of the middle class is depressed. Some people have pension wealth still. Wisconsin employees, state employees are very, very lucky to have just about the best pension plan in the country for state employees. It's well-managed. It's well-funded. And the reason it's well-funded is because those shares of stock in Apple and and other firms that our managers buy. Okay, the money managers do well in addition. But then there are the entrepreneurs who start their own businesses and the software guys. And then there are people who inherit wealth from their parents and so forth. And it turns out that if you're a really good saver, you're really well paid, you're going to do much better. And many of them, of course, in the financial services industry may be the most egregious example. That went from 2% of the economy in, I think, in 1990 to about 7% in 2007. And what those people did was, you know, was in build up these bubbles in housing and bid up asset prices and then get out before the pension funds and the rest of us were left holding the bag, okay? In fact, I know I have two very good friends, one at MIT and one at Harvard Business School, who believe that the financial services industry created absolutely no net wealth. They just redistributed it and they got out as in an inside job. They got out before and left other people holding the bag. And so there's problems there.
Nothing new in that. I mean, it's been done before.
It's been done before, but it hasn't been done to such a great extent as it's been done in the United States and so laxly regulated. Okay.
Right.
So the terrible problem, we have to keep the banks and keep them running, but you can't allow them to run away with all the benefits. And so one of my solutions is that why isn't there broader profit sharing within firms? If a firm is profitable, why should just the top 2 or 3% or the top 15 workers get stock options and bonuses? Why not give bonuses to the rest of the workers in the plant?
Okay.
Why not reward everybody?
Let me just kind of ask from the dark side, if you will. What's in it for the employer? What's in it for the owner?
In today's market, there's less in it for the owner because they know that you're expendable because there's 10 other people out there waiting for your job. But in the days when it was hard to find good employees and when good, loyal employees, this was like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, when it was hard to find good employees, that's important. People who are loyal to the firm work better and work harder. It costs a lot to replace a lot of types of workers and so forth. But there's a race between education and technology. There is an awful lot that a worker needs to do, work independently on their feet, hands and feet, use their mind. And this isn't just college graduates. This is everybody. So you need these skills, and that's the way the business is run. For instance, a perfect thing to do right now is to not hire permanent workers, to hire temps.
You don't have to pay benefits.
You don't. And some people, believe it or not, like that. Temping can be good if, let's say, your partner, your spouse, has a good job with health insurance, then you can afford to go temping. An awful lot of the software jobs and other things can be done from your home. Makes you very mobile, right? And at some point, you might find a firm and prove that you're really highly worthy, and then they turn you from a temp into a regular employee. But again, those are the higher educated, more skilled people. If you're a temp on the other end, you know, you're a temp doing this, that, and the other thing, there's no upward mobility. You move from place to place. Work is spotty. Your chances of catching on an internal job letter or a good job, which you work move up, are really low.
So, I mean, is this kind of a vicious cycle? I mean, I can see on the happy end of the scale, you have educated workers who are in demand by the employer, and he wants to keep them, and so he lets them have profit sharing, and that compounds itself.
And
they're more likely to stick around
and family leave and all that. Yeah,
right. Whereas if it starts to turn the other direction, there's this huge pool to draw from. They're expendable. The employer doesn't feel necessary to give them benefits or profit sharing.
I had a big debate with a person here at a function in Green Lake. And we couldn't understand why they couldn't get all the wonderful workers that at $10 an hour that they needed. And I said, well, it's $10 an hour. Well, we have some benefits, and the benefits I didn't think were that good, but we pay $10. I said, raise your wage. That's if you want better workers, pay $11 an hour. Well, we can't afford to do that. Well, then get involved in training people who can do what you want. Show them that if they start out at $10, you can move up the line and so forth. But, you know, they're just – a lot of frustrated people who produce things that used to be in demand In one case, it was someone who produced lathe wood products, and those wood products go into building new homes. So there's doors and railings and whatever. And if you're not building new homes, nobody's buying those things. Menards take some of them. Menards, you know, you could be fixing up your house, maybe. But unless you're building more new things, it's a tough business. And they're in a tough – I sympathize because they're in a bad way. But, you know, they weren't going to get what they wanted. Wonderful workers who – can be highly productive for 10 bucks an hour. Only in this economy might they. And then when times get better, they will lose those employees if they don't show them some internal growth. I have people who work for me who are just incredibly wonderful, and I know they're not going to work for me for a long time. In 4 or 5 years, they'll be gone. But boy, it's good to have somebody who for 4 or 5 years wants to learn, wants to get new good skills, does a good job, is an agreeable person than someone who says, oh, you can't fire me because I'm here and so on. And the world is full of that too. But it's just now that there's a race between technology, technological change, and education. And right now in the United States, technology is winning. We don't do a very good job graduating kids from college or with the right skills, some of which they can pick up at the employer. And because of that, the premiums for highly educated in our country are higher than in any other country because they're scarce. And, I mean, we need more entrepreneurs. People have asked me before, we don't live in an Evinrude economy in Wisconsin, a Sub-Zero economy, a Chevy economy, or a Harley-Davidson economy. We live in an Epic economy or a Northwest Mutual economy, business services and finance, software for medical record software, and those are the wave of the future. Highly sophisticated. People who work there are generally well-trained or who spend a lot of time working in computing. They have to go out, sell themselves, convince the employer that this product works, install the product, make it work, and so forth. And, you know, we just need more of that in the state. We don't have it right now. And manufacturing employment is not going back where it was. Manufacturing employment in this country has been dropping for 30 years, and it took a huge drop in the Great Recession, and in Wisconsin, we lost 125,000 jobs. Now we're back up 15,000 jobs, but we're never going to be up more than 30 or 40,000. It's just not going to happen.
Well, let's see if we can come up to some kind of a proposed solution for this recession. Maybe it starts
That's going to cost you way more money than you're paying me.
Maybe
if I had a good solution, you think I'd be here talking to you guys?
Well, maybe it starts in kindergarten. We'll see you in a moment here when we return. This is University of the Air. I'm Norman Gilliland, back with Emily Auerbach and our guest, Timothy Sneeding, and we're looking at the recession very much still with us. Is it a cycle? Is it something that's broken and can't be fixed? In either case, we want to do what we can to somehow improve things at least and have some reason for optimism. But if it's a cycle of any kind, somehow that cycle needs to be broken. And how do you start to do that? I mean, you start with the family?
Well, the cycle of poverty begins with parents who are not ready to be good parents to their children. Not because they don't want to be. Every parent wants to do everything they can for their children. But they don't have the skills or the capabilities, or they're working two jobs, or they're having a real rough go of life for themselves. They don't get along with, you know, there was a divorce or there was a split up and so forth. And we think the education of mobilization and equality and providing more equal opportunity in this country is the education system. But as we've seen, it's really hard. If a kid comes from a background, lives in a poor neighborhood, is brought up by an undereducated single parent with lots of different guys in the house, the kid's going to be in a less stable situation, less family-friendly. The mother or the father or both won't know as much about preparing the child. It starts before birth in terms of the pre-birth environment. It includes, you know, the mental health of the parents and the physical abuse, perhaps, for a kid from birth until they get to preschool. Then in preschool, high-quality preschool makes a difference. But it's hard to develop high-quality preschool for low-income kids. This is the real problem. So as one of my colleagues said very smartly, we have universal education from everybody, and schools are very different. So what if it makes you think if we had universal preschool, so that wouldn't be any different. There would be good ones and bad ones, and that's true. And to get a kid into a program where they can start to get some of the things they may not be getting at home, compensatory things, seems to work. But then there has to be that continuum. You have to hand off. And English as a second language is a big thing now, since 25% of the kids in this country right now are from parents who are foreign-born, and 50% in some big cities. Getting kids off to a right start so they're ready for school, and then finding effective schools which help keep kids moving ahead, which give them some hope for the future, which by the time they get to middle and to secondary school, that there's something brighter in their future than having a baby before they've had a partner and all that. Making that connection from either from high school to work. There are some really good school to work programs in technical fields where employers are involved. Career academies is one. Jim Kemple was here to talk about that last week. And Year Up, Gerald Chartavian's plan, they're both good. And they take disadvantaged kids and they give them a chance if the kid's willing to learn, and it's a no-nonsense thing. But they're linked to employers. And so employers know they can go to these programs and get the workers that they want. And then the rest, of course, go on to a four-year education, and they not only begin, they end. They get their degree in 4 or 5 years and without going tremendously in debt. And that's the sort of system that we need for the future. And it's really hard to start that system up for somebody now who is in 10th grade and they're bored. They don't know what they're doing. They don't like school. School isn't for them. They haven't really been prepared for 10th grade. They don't do math at all. And they just want to – they stop coming. They drop out. Come catch me if you can. You can't do much for those people. Unfortunately, many of them will end up in a criminal justice system, which will cost us a lot to keep them in prison. And when they get out, the odds against them getting a decent job and a good job are really, really big. So we need to work with youth more generally. We need public service programs that invest in young people, good preschool programs, good school programs, apprenticeships, and so forth. And that's what we need in this country. But that's a big investment, and somebody's got to make it. The state governments, you know, Scott Walker's not the only one who's facing huge health care bills because employer health insurance is failing and Medicaid is or Medicare is what there is. That costs a lot of money. And there's proven studies that Medicaid and health care expenditures and prison expenditures together squeeze these investments you'd make in kids, investments very self-servingly in faculty and in universities and so forth. So you want more from these developmental institutions, but you're squeezing them at the same time. So it's difficult, isn't it?
The problem seems so immense. I'm curious if you try to picture 5 years from now or 10 years from now, both in Wisconsin in particular and then nationwide, do you feel optimistic or pessimistic?
Well, I've been a pessimist, and unfortunately, the people I used to know who are optimistic are now pessimistic. I've given this talk at the National Academy of Sciences, at the Wisconsin Academy last week I talked about, and people leave and they're really depressed. But if we stay the course now, things are starting to turn around a little bit. Those jobs are growing more slowly. We're going to need more tax revenue, and not just from the rich. The rich can't trust me, I'm at the upper end of the distribution, and by the time you get done with the ACA and the higher Medicare taxes and repealing the Bush tax credits, I can't afford to pay more. But I am paying more. I want you to know that. And I'm expecting to get less out of that Social Security and Medicare program if things happen. But I would sacrifice much more to invest in children. As Timothy taxpayer living in University Heights and paying huge taxes, I want the Madison public school system to convince me they can hire good teachers with that money, that those teachers can educate children, all children, bring them up, including those from the wrong side of the tracks or come from less advantaged backgrounds and give them a chance to get ahead. And if you do, you got here, you got my dollars. But you have to convince me that you can do this. You have to convince me that you can make schools better, that you can increase graduation rates. And so that's a challenge. But this is a wealthy country. There are opportunities to get ahead. I think if we subsidize jobs for the least skilled, if we make them less expensive to hire, that many of them will catch on as the economy recovers and get jobs and maybe stay in those jobs. But in the short term, I don't see any great solutions. I mean, staying the course, I think, is as best we can do.
Now, you're head of a large corporation, one of these corporations, mm-hmm. let's say, that's sitting on all this money, mm-hmm. trillions of dollars. What's going to get you to invest?
Some hope, some belief that the economy is getting better, whether those sales are in Europe or Latin America or Asia, that you can sell products there. Export is really important. If you can't sell the domestic markets, you can sell exports. And the workers who produce those exports are here in this country. So that builds wages. That will build domestic demand. As domestic demand picks back up, things will eventually get moving. I mean, we have a number of wonderful devices, the telecommunications and things we didn't have, which do allow people to be much more productive and useful, but which also mean that the work that used to be done by people can be done by these machines now. So it's an upskilling, a general upskilling of the population, and trying to find a way to give the people I care about, the low-skill, lower-end people, a chance to get ahead, a chance to move up, and a chance to have a job, a chance to build a career, a chance to do the right thing. And so I may be in 7 or 8 years, I'm hopeful, but in the short term, it was worse last year and it was mm-hmm. worse the year before, but it is not good now.
But you're not expecting another plunge into sort of a worse recession again?
I hope to God not. I think in the Europe has already mm-hmm. done this. The Irish have done this. They cut back and they're going deeper now. The Brits are recovering from a double dip. If we massively cut investment expenditures in children, the non-entitlements, and if we continue to have health care eat a bigger and bigger share of our national income, which that's slowed lately, that's good news, no, we're in trouble then. Because the government needs to be the engine that starts this economy. If you look at, for instance, look at public sector employment. One of the graphs I had on my talk for the Wisconsin Academy, you can see that at the beginning of the recession, the money that Obama Incorporated put aside for the American Recovery and Relief Act, which was distributed directly to states to keep people working and processing Medicaid claims and teachers and so forth work. When that money stopped now, we've dropped public sector employment by 9% relative to population, a huge decline. Where's it going to come from? If housing market's depressed and people aren't paying property taxes, people aren't buying things, sales taxes are low, then you're telling the states, oh, you have to pay much more for health care and so forth. The states get squeezed. So you need the federal government to help out the states in short term. I think there are some important infrastructure projects we could be doing. We should say yes to the next big railroad that wants to come by.
if we get the chance.
I'm sorry, environmentalists out there. The head of the Wisconsin Academy was aghast to hear me say this, but we should build that Keystone pipeline. Thank you very much. And we should do all sorts of other things to kickstart employment and get the government going in the short term. At the same time, in the long term, we have to ensure those people who are buying our bonds that we're worthwhile. The Chinese and the Asians who save a lot, who buy our government bonds at low interest rates, have the full faith in us to repay them. We have to do that. We cannot run a government as we have for the last 5 years, where you spend 21% of GDP and tax 18. You can't spend $21 or $2,100 every week and do that on $1,800 a year worth of income. You can't do it for long. You're in debt. And that's the issue. So there is a long-term debt issue. And I wish that the Democrats would address that issue. At the same time, the Republicans have to be a little more wise about who's done well in this country and how small a group that is and how much more brown, yellow, and black this country is getting and how they have to do something to help those people catch up and get ahead too. So I'm an internal optimist, even when I sounded like a pessimist.
Well, thanks for sharing both optimism and some pessimism with us, Timothy Sneeding.
Thank you. And it's been my pleasure.
Very enlightening hour. I'm Norman Gilliland with Emily Auerbach, and I hope you can join us for the next hour of University of the Air.